Right, today we're going to take a look at another application of dynamic programming. This time, we're going to use dynamic programming to solve a version of the shortest paths problem, a version known as the all pairs shortest path problem. Okay. Now, we've seen the shortest path problem earlier, and the earlier version we saw was the single source all destination problem, where you had to find shortest paths from a given source or start vertex to all of the vertices in the graph. In the all pairs version, we have to find the shortest path between every pair of vertices. Okay. So in this problem, we start with an n vertex directed weighted graph. The weights give you the lengths of the edges, say. And the objective is to find the shortest path from every vertex I to every vertex j. So really, you have a total of n square shortest paths to find for the n square different pairs of vertices. So for example, if you had the seven vertex graph, our objective is to find a shortest path from 1 to 1, 1 to 2, 1 to 3, and so on up to 1 through 7, as well as from 2 to 1, 2 to 2, 2 to 3, 2 to 4, 2 to 5, 6, 7, 8, shortest path from 6 to vertex 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay. So we have an 8 vertex graph. Here we need to find 64 shortest paths. Okay. Now, so I mentioned earlier, we've seen an algorithm called Dijkstra's algorithm, and this one finds n shortest paths, one path for each destination, but all of these paths begin at the same source vertex. Okay, so you're given one source vertex, total of n vertices, so you find the shortest path from the source vertex to each of your n vertices. And Dijkstra's single source shortest path algorithm, if you recall, works in order of n square time. Now, we could certainly use Dijkstra's shortest path algorithm to solve the all pairs shortest path problem. And the way we would do that is simply invoke Dijkstra's algorithm n times, once for each of the n vertices being the source. Okay. So I'll call Dijkstra's algorithm first with vertex 1 of my graph as the source vertex. And then I'll call it with vertex 2 as the source, then with vertex 3 as the source, and so on. And in this particular case, I would invoke Dijkstra's shortest path algorithm 8 times. Okay. First beginning with vertex 1, then vertex 2, vertex 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. And following these n invocations, I would have found all n square shortest paths. Okay. So I would have solved the all pairs shortest path problem. If I were to do this, since I'm invoking Dijkstra's algorithm n times, and the complexity of Dijkstra's algorithm is order of n square, my overall runtime would be order of n cube. Okay. Now, it's important to keep in mind that Dijkstra's shortest path algorithm works only when you do not have an edge whose cost is less than zero. So that's kind of a restriction on it. So under the assumption that no edge has a cost smaller than zero, we'd be able to find all of our shortest paths, so solve the all-pairs shortest path problem in order of n cubed time by applying Dijkstra's algorithm n times. Okay. Now, the dynamic programming solution we're going to develop today, this one runs in theta of n cubed time. Okay. So when you compare this with O of n cubed for n applications of Dijkstra, you see that this one here always takes n cubed time, whereas n applications of Dijkstra isn't going to take more than n cubed. So you'd expect that the former solution, n applications of Dijkstra, is going to outperform our dynamic programming solution on some graphs where it doesn't actually take the n cubed time. So for example, if the graph is sparse, you have a small number of edges, Dijkstra's could run faster than the dynamic programming solution we're going to develop today. At the same time, the overheads for the dynamic programming solution we're going to develop today are smaller, so that when the graph gets pretty dense, then the dynamic programming solution would run faster by some factor. Okay. More importantly, the restriction on the dynamic programming solution, the restriction that the graphs need to satisfy here, isn't as stringent. We do not require that all edges have a non-negative cost, as does Dijkstra's algorithm. What we require is that the graph should not have a cycle whose length is less than zero. Okay. So you can still have edges that have a cost that is less than zero, but you can't have a cycle whose cost is less than zero. Okay. And that's not too severe a restriction. Okay. There are applications where the graphs we build will have edges whose cost is less than zero. And in fact, the text talks about some, and on the website there are some other applications listed. Okay. But as far as a graph that has a cycle whose length is zero, that's somewhat less common. And when in fact you do have a cycle whose length is zero, then you have some shortest paths that aren't finite in the sense that the number of edges on those paths could be infinite. Okay. And in fact, the length of the path would be negative infinity. Okay. So for example, suppose that vertex 1 is on a cycle, and the length of that cycle is minus 2. Okay. Then each time you go around the cycle, you start at vertex 1, the cycle brings you back to vertex 1, and the cost of your path has gone down by 2. Okay. So if you were to repeat this process, okay, so you just keep going around the cycle many, many times, you keep reducing the cost of the path. So really, the shortest path from vertex 1 to itself, for example, has a length that's minus infinity. Okay. Okay. So I mentioned earlier, the dynamic programming algorithm is simpler to code, has smaller overheads, and so can be expected to run faster than in applications of Dijkstra's algorithm, at least when graphs have a large number of edges. So you're looking at dense graphs. Okay. Okay. But the important thing is that the dynamic programming solution does allow you to have negative cost edges. The restriction is not as severe as in the case of Dijkstra's algorithm. You cannot have a negative cost cycle. Okay. All right, so let's turn our attention now to the development of the dynamic programming solution. Okay. This algorithm that we'll develop will be called or is known as Floyd's shortest paths algorithm. Now, to come up with a dynamic programming solution to any problem, the first thing you need to do is you need to view the solution as the result of a sequence of decisions. So we have to have this concept of a decision sequence nailed down. Okay. So in the context of building a shortest path, okay, so we're building a shortest path from vertex I to vertex j. Okay. And to get the shortest path, I need to look at the construction of the shortest path as the result of a decision sequence or a sequence of decisions. Several decision sequences probably pop up in your mind right now. To build the shortest path from I to J, I could maybe first decide, well, what is the next vertex I go to? Okay. And then from there, what is the next one I go to? Then what is the next one I go to? What is the next one I go to? And so on. Okay. So one decision sequence is pick your start vertex for the path I, decide the next vertex, then the next vertex, until you finally reach the vertex J. An alternative would be to work backwards. Okay. So you start building your path not from I towards J, but from J backwards to I. So you say, let me decide first on the last vertex, okay, the next to last vertex on the path, the one just before J. Okay. Having made this decision, I will then decide on the vertex that comes just before that, the vertex just before that, before that, before that, and so on, until I find my way back to I. Okay. Now, although many different decision sequences may pop up when you're trying to come up with a decision sequence for a particular problem, some of these you can actually develop into good dynamic programming algorithms, and others you can't. Okay. Now, in this particular case, the decision sequence that we're going to use is different from the two I just mentioned. Rather than make decisions from I to J or from J to I, we're going to make them in a rather unusual fashion. We're going to first decide on what is the highest intermediate vertex that's going to be in there, okay, in between I and J. Okay. So by highest here, I'm looking at the vertex numbers. Okay. So the vertices are numbered from 1 through n. 2 is higher than 1, 3 is higher than 2, 9 is higher than 8, and so on. Okay. So rather than decide on the intermediate vertices from left to right or right to left, I'm going to say, well, on this shortest path from I to J, what is the highest vertex, okay, highest intermediate vertex over here? What is its number? Okay. All right, so that's somewhat unusual. You may wonder, well, how did anybody think about doing it that way? Okay. And there's really no great answer to that question. Okay. So you kind of sit and stare, and one day you come up with this idea which says, I'm going to make decisions by first deciding on the highest index vertex. Okay. Once you've decided that, well, then we can look at this left subpath and decide on the highest one in there. And then that splits the blue path into two. We could look at the left part of that and decide on the highest in there and so on. Okay. So we can fill in the intermediate vertices in order of highest intermediate vertex on the path or subpaths. Okay. All right. So for example, if you suppose that the shortest path from vertex I to vertex J goes through 2, 6, 3, 8, 5, 7. So 2, 6, 3, 8, 5, 7, these are the intermediate vertices. Okay. So when you're looking at highest, we're only looking at the largest of these numbers. I might be 9, J might be 20, but those two don't qualify as intermediate vertices. Okay. So the highest intermediate vertex on this shortest path is vertex 8. Okay. So in this decision sequence that I'm looking at, my first decision when building the shortest path from 1 to J would be that 8 is going to be on that path. Having made that decision, I could then look at one of these two subpaths, the left subpath and the right subpath, and if I look at the left one first, I would then decide, well, what is the highest vertex on that left subpath? So I would decide it's going to be 6. Okay. Then I could look at one of the subpaths that remains. That could be the I to 6, the 6 to 8, or the 8 to J path. If I'm looking at the I to 6, I would decide what is the highest vertex on that path? I would decide it's 2. When I'm looking at the I to 2 path, I would decide that there is no intermediate vertex on the I to 2 path. Okay. All right, so the idea is you first decide on the highest vertex on the path. That splits the path into two. You pick up one of the two and then decide the highest vertex on that, and you continue until you have made decisions on all intermediate vertices. All right, once we have the decision sequence in mind, we pretty much have our problem state description locked up. Okay. So in our case here, we're going to decide on the highest vertex on the path, and that motivates us then to have a state descriptor, which is a triple. Okay. So once you decide, say, the highest vertex here is going to be 8, then when you're looking at the blue path, we're going to be looking for a shortest path from I to 8, which goes through no vertex bigger than 8, because we already know that 8 is the biggest or highest all across. We have no negative cycles, which means that there's really no need to repeat 8. Okay. So if you had 8 out here and you had 8 there, then from this 8 to that 8, you'd have a cycle. Okay. There's no advantage to a cycle because there are no cycles of negative cost. Okay. So once you've decided on your highest vertex 8, then we're going to argue that the blue path needs to be a shortest path from I to 8, and it has the added restriction that the intermediate vertices cannot be bigger than 8 because 8 is the biggest or highest vertex all across. Okay. So with that as motivation, we end up with a state descriptor which says our state is ijk. We're looking for a shortest path from I to J going through no vertex larger than k. So when we start, we're looking for a shortest path from I to J, and at this time there are no restrictions on intermediate vertices. However, since there's no vertex bigger than n, okay, the vertices are numbered 1 through n, no restriction translates in our triple as shortest path from I to J with the restriction that no vertex is bigger than n. Okay. But there are no vertices bigger than n, so really it's no restriction. Okay. All right, so that's what you're looking for when you start, and if you decide that the highest index is 8, then the claim is going to be that the left part, you're going to be looking for I to 8, going through no vertex bigger than 8. And I guess here you're going to be doing, I to 8, going through no vertex bigger than 7. Okay. You're not allowed to repeat 8, so 7 would be the biggest allowed there. Then here you'd be going from 8 to J, and nobody in here can be bigger than 7. Okay. So your state would have moved from IJN to a pair, which would be I87 and 8J7. Okay. Now, once you have a state, then you define a cost function on the state. Okay. So cost function on our triples. Okay. So C will just give us the length of a shortest path from vertex I to J, no intermediate vertex bigger than K. Okay. All right, so with that, if you try K equals N, then our definition says that Cijn is the length of a shortest path from I to J with no intermediate vertex bigger than N. As I said earlier, we have no vertex that is bigger than N, and therefore that's no restriction. And so Cijn is the length of the shortest path from I to J. Okay. So if all you were interested in was to find the length of the shortest paths, then once you had computed all of the Cijn values, you would have the length of all of your n squared shortest paths. Of course, we want to find the path also, so we need to do something more than just compute the Cs. Okay, so if you were to look at our example graph then, with 8 vertices, C1, 3, 8 would be the length of the shortest path from 1 to 3 with no restrictions. C5, 4, 8 would be the length of the shortest path from 5 to 4 with no restrictions. On the other hand, C6, 7, 0 would be the length of the shortest path from 6 to 7 going through no vertex bigger than 0. Okay. But since every vertex is bigger than 0, that means you can't go through a vertex. So you have to go directly from 6 to 7. So C6, 7, 0 would be the cost of the edge from 6 to 7. Similarly, C3, 6, 0, shortest path from 3 to 6, no vertex bigger than 0 in between, means no vertex in between, so you have to use the edge only 3 to 6. Okay, so C6, 3, 6, 0 would be 9. Okay. All right, so as I said, Cij0 is the length of a shortest path from I to J, no intermediate vertex bigger than 0, and therefore Cij0 is just the length of the edge from I to J. Okay. If the edge doesn't exist, then Cij0 becomes infinity, or you put some large number, max int, if infinity is not a legal number to use in your system. Okay, so our objective is to compute all of the Cs. Later we'll see how to modify the algorithm we come up with so that we can actually construct the shortest paths. But as I said, once you've computed all the Cs, you know the length of the shortest paths. Okay. And to compute the Cs, we're going to develop the recurrence equation. And in the recurrence equation, we need to show that the principle of optimality holds. We also need a recurrence stopper. Okay. The recurrence stopper for us is going to be the Cij0 values. Okay. So Cij0 is something that's easy to obtain once you know the graph. You just read off the cost of the corresponding edge, and if the edge is not present, you use a value such as infinity or some large number. Now, for the case when k is bigger than 0, here we're going to rely on a recurrence, and to come up with this recurrence, we'll need to verify that the principle of optimality actually holds. Okay. All right, so we're looking for the length of the shortest path from I to J, no intermediate vertex bigger than k. Okay. Now, if you're looking for that, then we know that the shortest path with this property, one, it can't go through anybody bigger than k, and therefore, you have two options. You either go through the vertex K, and of course, you can't repeat K, because repeating K would mean you have a cycle, and you don't have a negative length cycle in the graph, so there's no advantage to repeating a vertex in between. Okay. All right, so the shortest path that we're looking for the state IJK, okay, right, this can either go through the vertex K, so K could be an intermediate vertex, or K may not be an intermediate vertex. Those are the only two possibilities. You either go through K or you don't go through K. Okay. You can't, of course, go through anything bigger than K. Okay. All right, so if you do not go through K, then the biggest vertex you can go through is K minus 1. And if the biggest is K minus 1, then we know that Cijk must have the value equal to Cijk minus 1. Okay, this says length the shortest path from I to J, no intermediate vertex bigger than K minus 1. All right, so there are two possibilities for the shortest ijk path. You either go through vertex k or you don't go through vertex k. If you don't go through vertex k, then cijk is easily determined. It's just cijk minus 1. Okay. So if you look at this picture here, the largest intermediate vertex is constrained to be nothing bigger than k, and if you don't go through k, then the largest intermediate vertex is smaller than k minus, is smaller than k, which means it's not bigger than k minus 1. And by definition, then the length of this shortest path from I to j is cij k minus 1. Okay. All right, the other possibility for your shortest ijk path is that you actually go through vertex k. Okay. So if you do go through vertex k, okay, this is now your largest intermediate vertex. Okay. Then, as I've said before, we can assume that vertex k is not repeated. So in the blue segment here, the highest intermediate vertex you could have is k minus 1. Okay. So you can't have anybody bigger than k minus 1 there. You can't have anybody bigger than k minus 1 here in this red segment either. Okay. All right, so once we've settled the fact that the blue and the red segments can't have an intermediate vertex bigger than minus 1, then we're going to make the claim that the blue path, okay, the I to K path, must be a shortest I to K path going through no vertex larger than K minus 1. Okay. The second part we already know. You're not going through a vertex larger than K minus 1. We don't know at this point that you're the shortest I to K path with that restriction. Okay. Now, suppose that were not true. Then we'd say, well, take this blue path, throw it out, and put in this yellow path, okay, where this yellow path is a shorter I to K path under the same restriction. Okay. If you did that, then the yellow path followed by the red path would be shorter than the blue path followed by the red path. Okay. And that would contradict your claim that the blue path followed by the red path was the shortest I to J path, no vertex bigger than K. So if the blue path is not the shortest I to K path, no vertex bigger than K minus 1, then there's a shorter such path, the yellow path. We could replace the blue path by the yellow path, giving us a shorter I to J path, no vertex bigger than K. Okay. And since that's not possible, because by assumption, the blue path followed by the red one is the shortest I to J path, no vertex bigger than K, we know that this statement here must be true. Okay. So the blue path must be the shortest I to K path going through no vertex bigger than K minus 1. Okay. And a similar argument shows that the red path must be the shortest K to J path going through no vertex bigger than K minus 1. Okay. And what that means then is that the length of the blue path, by definition then, is Cijk K minus 1. Okay. Length of shortest path from I to K, no vertex bigger than K minus 1. The length of the red path is CKJ K minus 1. Length of shortest path from K to J, no vertex bigger than K minus 1. Okay. All right, so once we have this, okay, we're able to write our recurrence, but implicit in all of these arguments, what we've done is we've shown that the principle of optimality holds, which says that once you have decided that vertex K is the largest vertex here, then you get two subproblems, the IJ K minus 1 problem here and the KJ K minus 1 problem here. The solution for the left subproblem must be a shortest path under the constraints for that problem, and the paths here, the red one, must be a shortest path under the constraints for this subproblem. Okay. So it doesn't matter what your k is. Once you've decided on k, the two subproblems you get must have optimal shortest paths. Okay. All right, so turning back to the development of the recurrence, what we have seen is that the length of the blue path is ci kk minus 1. The length of the red path is ck j k minus 1. And so what that tells you is that the length of the path from I to j is the sum of the length of the blue and the red paths. Since the shown ij path is the shortest ijk path, okay, shortest path from I to j, no vertex bigger than k, you get cijk is the sum. Okay. All right, so now we have two equations for cijk. We had the first one, which said cijk is equal to cijk minus 1, and that was arrived under the assumption that the shortest ijk path does not go through vertex k. And now we have another equation different from the first one, and this one was derived under the assumption that you go through vertex k. Okay. And as we noted earlier, these are the only two options. Okay. Now, we don't know which one's going to happen. Okay. What we do know is that since cijk is the length of the shortest ijk path, you must pick the option which gives you the smaller result. Okay. And therefore, we can conclude that cijk is the smaller of what you get from the two options that you have. Okay. So we don't really need to know whether you're going through vertex k or not. All we need to know is that you have to take the better of the two options of going through k or not going through k. And so we can capture that by this equation that we have over here. Okay. All right, so this gives us our recurrence for cijk. Okay. To solve this recurrence, because we want to compute cijn, we know cij0 for all I and j. Okay, that's just the length of the edge from I to j. Okay. And then if you look at this equation, the right-hand side of this equation, that's the stuff to the right of the equals, the third parameter here is smaller than the third parameter on the left side. Okay, so here you got a k, and here you got k minus 1, so that's your third parameter. So the way to solve this recurrence is to solve it in increasing order of k. Okay, we already know the value when k is 0. Next, we'll find all the cijs when k is 1. When you're doing that, on the right side, you're going to need the values with the third parameter being 0, which we know. Once we've got all the cij ones, we can then get the cij twos, because when you put k equals 2 here, on the right side, you'll have a 1. Okay. When you've got all the cij twos, you can get the cij threes, because when k is 3, on the right side, these third parameters will be 2. Okay. So the sequence is, do it in the order k equals 1, 2, 3, up through n. And that gives us the following algorithm, which says we have a loop, solve that equation, k going from 1 through n, and inside the loop, we're going to compute all of the cijs. So we have two nested loops to do all of the cijs, and then we have a line in there which says cijk, and we just put down our recurrence. Okay. And really, that's all there is to Floyd's algorithm. Okay. So I have a single line inside, which looks like this. Okay. I, prior to starting these three nested for loops, I initialize cij0 to be the length of the edge from I to j. Okay. And once I've done that, I just need these really four lines of code here. And when this thing terminates, I have the value of cijn, which is the length of a shortest path from I to j with no restrictions. Now, it's not hard to see that the complexity of this is order of n cube. You have three nested for loops all running from 1 through n. So this line is going to be hit n cube times. And each execution of this thing is order of 1. So you got an order of n cube. Okay. And if you want to be more precise, it's really theta of n cube, because you're always going to enter this loop n cube times, like it or not. Okay, now that we have our n-cube algorithm, we're going to try and refine it. Okay. There are some problems with the algorithm as it stands. And the problem has to do with the amount of space it needs. As it stands, we need a three-dimensional array to implement our C function here. And the three dimensions will all run from 1 through n, so you need n cube amount of space. We'd like to cut this thing down to n square. All right, so to reduce the space, we take a look at our recurrence equation. And suppose you fix the value of k. So we're looking at the kth iteration of that outermost loop. And if you're computing Cij's that are not on the kth column or the kth row. So if you look at the case where I is not equal to k, so it means you're not on this row, as well as j is not equal to k, so you're not on this column. So we're trying to compute a Cij k for a position other than on our yellow column and yellow row. So let's say you're looking at a value out here. Then the formula tells us that Cij k is the smaller of Cij k minus 1. So the previously computed value here. Cik k minus 1. So we're going to go Cik, so that's down here. That's this value here. Cik k minus 1 from the previous iteration. Ckj, so row k, column j, that's this one here. So to compute a value that's not on the yellow column and yellow row, we need to know the old value, the k minus 1 value, and we need to know the k minus 1 value on the same row, but in the k column here, this yellow column, and the same column, but this yellow row down here. So once we have computed the new value here, so once we've computed this min, and then I try to compute something else, well, then I don't need this one anymore. The only values that get used many times are the ones that are on this column, and the ones on this row. For example, this value here is used to recompute all the values on this row. Similarly, this value here is going to be used to recompute all the values on that column. So if you're on a yellow column or yellow row, you're going to get used many times. If you're not, then you get used only once, and that's in the recomputation of your new value. And what that tells you is that when you rewrite or when you compute Cijk, you can overwrite Cijk minus 1. You don't need new space for that. You can just write it over the old value. All right, now if you look at values that are on those yellow rows and columns, and for example, if you look at being on the yellow row, at that time I equals k. So if you plug in I equals k into our formula here, replace I by k in these two terms, you end up with this thing down here. Now, over here, this stuff here, this term, ckk k minus 1, is the length of a shortest path from k to k going through no vertex bigger than k minus 1. This is really a cycle. So length of a shortest path from k to k with or without any restrictions is 0. You don't move from there. You just sit there. Since there are no negative length cycles, ck k minus 1, kk k minus 1 has to be 0. And then we just copy this term over. So get rid of the 0 from here. You see that ckjk is the same as ckjk minus 1. And what that means is that on the kth iteration, the new value of ckj is the same as its old value, regardless of whether you compute it using this equation or you don't. And in turn, what that means is that cijk can overwrite cijk minus 1. You're only overwriting it by the same value it had prior to the overwrite, so it shouldn't affect anything. All right, a similar argument tells you that you can overwrite the values on the column also, on that yellow column. Okay, so regardless of whether you're computing in the kth iteration a value on the yellow column or the yellow row, you can overwrite the old value it's not going to change the result. Okay. And with that observation, we can simplify Floyd's shortest path algorithm. The statement inside previously had a third parameter, which was k out here, and then k minus 1, k minus 1, k minus 1. If I drop the third parameter, then what I'm doing is I'm saying, take the old value of Cij, which was Cij k minus 1. Take the old value of Cik, which is Cik k minus 1. The old value here, add them up, take them in, put them back into the same spot here. Okay. So the old value of Cij is being overwritten by the new value of Cij. Okay. All right, and we've proved that it shouldn't matter that you drop the third parameter. Okay. And initially, we were starting with Cij 0. Now that value is just sitting in Cij. Okay. All right, so we can cut the amount of space down to n square. All we do is we throw away the third parameter in the previous version of the algorithm. It doesn't affect the outcome one bit. When you finish, Cij is Cijn. Okay. All right, the time complexity is not affected. All right, to build the shortest paths, we need to do extra work. We need to keep track a quantity called k, which is the largest vertex in the shortest path from I to j. Okay. And then we'll see in a moment that using this value, we can build all of the shortest paths. Okay. Now, initially, that's when you start. Cij is the length of a shortest path going through no vertex bigger than 0. So Cij is really Cij 0. There are no intermediate vertices, so in particular, there's no largest intermediate vertex. So strictly speaking, Kij is undefined, but we'll give it the value 0 to have something definite there. Okay. All right, so we modify our code. Previously, we had a line here which just said Cij is min of Cij and this thing. Now we're saying that, well, if the min is actually Cik plus Ckj, then we're taking the option of going through vertex k as our largest intermediate vertex. So at this time, I need to update the value of k. Okay. Otherwise, the rest of it is the same. Okay. So if I take this line out, Kij equals k, what I've got here is something which just says Cij is the min of Cij, Cik plus Ckj. But with this thing here, I'm saying if the option is to go through vertex k, then update k, Kay, to be that vertex. Okay. So this keeps track of the highest vertex you go through when you are building, when you're computing Cij. Okay. All right, so let's work through an example now. So I'm going to, here's my example graph, same as before, 8 vertices. So I'm going to start with an 8x8 array of C values. So this is really my Cij 0. Okay. This is my Cij 0 matrix, and of course it's only stored in a 2D stuff, so it's a Cij. Okay. I put in all the edge costs. I put dashes out here where there are no edges. In a real implementation, you know, if the data type for the elements is object, you might put a null out there. If you're using ints, you'd want to put something large. Earlier I'd said you could do a max int. You may not want to do a max int because we're going to need to add two numbers, Cij, two C's together when we're doing our computation. And if you add two very large numbers together, you're going to get an overflow, so you may not get the right results. And so you need to then be a little more careful and pick a suitably large number so that when you add them, you don't get an overflow. All right, so we run through the code. We're not going to go through that manually. It's going to take too much time here. You end up with a matrix such as this. Okay, this is your C matrix, which is the same as the Cijn's. Okay. And let me go back to that for a moment. From this matrix, the information you get, for example, is that the shortest path from 1 to 2 has length 6. The shortest path from 1 to 3 has length 5. The shortest path from 8 to 1 has length 5, from 8 to 2 it's 11, and so on. Okay. So you can read off the lengths of the shortest paths. Okay. The K matrix produced there looks like this, and what this tells you is that the shortest path from 1 to 2 has vertex 4 as its highest intermediate vertex. The shortest path from 3 to 1 has vertex 7 as its highest intermediate vertex. The shortest path from 8 to 3 has vertex 7 as its highest intermediate vertex. Okay. All right, now using these k values, we're going to be able to build entire shortest paths, not just know what is the highest vertex on the shortest path. Okay. See how it's done? Let's first take a look at the shortest path in this graph from vertex 1 to 7. Okay. So let's first identify the path without going through our K-matrix, and then we'll see how, using the K-matrix, we can reconstruct it. Okay. Now, if you stare at this long enough, you'll see that the shortest path from 1 to 7 starts at 1, goes to 4, then to 5, then, sorry, 1 to 4, to 2, to 5, to 8, to 6, and then to 7. And the length of this path is 14. Okay. And we'd like to construct this path using our K-matrix rather than staring at this graph. Okay. All right, so there's our K-matrix. Here's the path we're trying to build. It's a unique shortest path from 1 to 7. So we should be able to get it using our K-matrix. The way we're going to do it is we're going to first say, well, what is the highest vertex on the path from 1 to 7? Okay, so for that, I go to my K-matrix. It says the highest vertex is 8. So that tells me the path looks something like this. The yellows represent paths which may possibly have intermediate vertices on them. Okay, so from 1, I'm going to somehow get to 8 using the shortest path from 1 to 8. From 8, I'm going to somehow get to 7 using the shortest path from 8 to 7. Okay. Okay, so now I need to resolve this yellow arrow and that yellow arrow. Okay, so working on this one first, I look at K18. K18 is a 5, which tells me that the highest vertex on the path, shortest path from 1 to 8 is vertex 5. So I now end up with this configuration, which says from 1, you're going to take a shortest path to 5, then a shortest path to 8, and then a shortest path to 7. I got to get rid of these yellow arrows to end up with my final path. I work, let's say, on this arrow first. So K15 is a 4. So that splits the arrow up into this configuration. All right, so again, let me look at the leftmost arrow. So I look at K14 is a 0. That tells me there's no intermediate vertex on the shortest path from 1 to 4. So I throw away the arrow, and now it looks like this. All right, then I look at this fellow. I need K45. That's a 2. So that arrow breaks into two arrows like this. Okay. Now you need K42, which is a 0. So there's no intermediate vertex from 4 to 2. You get rid of that. Okay. All right, we now look like this. Then we're going to work on this yellow arrow here. There's no intermediate vertex between the short on the shortest path from 2 to 5 either, because K25 is 0. So now we look like this. We're going to work on this yellow arrow, 5-8. K5-8 is also 0. And so there's no intermediate vertex over there. So we now look like this. Then we're going to work on this one, K8-7. Well, that's a 6. So that yellow arrow splits into two smaller ones, looking like this. Okay, 8 to 6, 6 to 7. Okay. To resolve these, we pick up the leftmost one in our example. So K86 is a 0, no intermediate vertex there. You look at K67, that's a 0, no intermediate vertex there. We got rid of all of those yellow arrows, and now we have the shortest path from 1 to 7. Okay. All right, so using the K values, we can build the shortest paths. Each time you use a K value, you introduce one intermediate vertex. The number of intermediate vertices cannot be more than n minus 2. So after n minus 2 applications of this process, you must have built the shortest path. Okay. You can write a program to output the shortest path. Given the vertices I and j, shortest path from I to j, our program will not output the vertex I, but all of the remaining vertices. Okay. So if I equals j, then there is no intermediate vertex. You're just starting at a vertex, staying out there. So you return. There's nothing else to output. if Kij is 0, that means there's no intermediate vertex from I to j. Okay. So in this case, we just print out the next vertex on the path, which is vertex j. Okay. And here I'm printing out a blank space. Okay. If Kij is not 0, then you have an intermediate vertex. So in that case, I will recursively print out the shortest path from I to the highest intermediate vertex, and then I will print out the path from that intermediate vertex to j. Okay, and that's it. That's our algorithm to output the shortest path. Okay. All right, so each time you come in here, you're going to put out a vertex, unless, of course, there are no vertices. So this thing will get called as many times as you have intermediate vertices on the path. Okay. All right, the complexity of this thing is linear in the number of vertices on the shortest path. Okay. The first vertex is not output, the remaining are. So if your shortest path has 8 vertices, including the start one, you'll need to go in there 7 times. All right, so the complexity is linear in the number of vertices on the shortest path. Okay, so we've seen how we can use dynamic programming to solve the all-pairs shortest path problem. The difficult part in this, of course, is coming up with the decision sequence that gives you an algorithm that has a suitable complexity. And here we had to use a somewhat non-intuitive decision sequence. Intuitive would have been decide the second vertex on the path, the third, fourth, fifth, and so on, or backwards. Non-intuitive is first decide on the highest vertex and then pick up each segment and decide the highest vertex in each segment and so on. Okay. But once you have this decision sequence in mind, the rest of what we did is somewhat mechanical. Okay. This definition of that triple that we had, IJK, the coming up with the recurrence equations, well, those are fairly mechanical steps once you've figured out the decision sequence. The code is fairly simple. There are no fancy data structures used, but it does run in theta of n cubed time, whereas n applications of Dijkstra would be order of n cubed, and in particular on graphs that don't have too many edges, Dijkstra would run faster. Okay. We saw that in addition to finding the costs, we could find the actual shortest paths if we included another variable called k, which kept track of the highest vertex on a shortest path. Once you have computed the c values, that which take n cubed time, each shortest path can be constructed in order of n time. Total number of shortest paths to construct is n square. So in n cubed time, you could get all of your shortest paths also. Okay. Okay. We are going to take a look at one more application of dynamic programming in our next lecture. All right. Thank you.